I'd like to start with a story that explains some things for me personally, and perhaps for you too, but explains for me both socially and theologically where many of us come from or what many of us struggle with as we look at racial issues in the United States. And the story is an old one, you may have heard it, of this man that was walking along the edge of a cliff, just kind of enjoying the view. To his left are the mountains, and to the right, straight off the cliff, was this river flowing about 300 feet below. And he's looking at the mountains, he's looking at the river, and the mountains and the river, and he trips and falls, and he falls off the cliff. Well, as luck would have it, about halfway down the cliff was a branch sticking out, and he grabbed this branch on the way down, and it stopped him. And there he is, 150 feet above the river, and 150 feet from the top, and, you know, I mean, that's quite a predicament, right? And he cries out, "Can anybody help me? Help, I need help." And the clouds begin to storm together, and a big voice rumbles out of the clouds, "Yes, I can help you. Who are you?" "I am God." "Are you sure you can help me?" "I'm sure I can help you." "What do I have to do?" "Let go." "Is there anybody else up there?" And what that does, the story does for me, again, socially and theologically, in the story it suggests to come to God, the man has to let go of his branch. And I suspect that as we look at our attitudes and our perceptions of the world, we have a lot of branches to let go of before we come to the truth. The man lets go of his branch and he can finally see God. We let go, perhaps, of a lot of our perceptions of how America works and how our attitudes have been shaped before we come to the truth. It's Richard Wright, that real famous, I think, black American writer who said, "I have discovered the secret hidden core of race relations in the United States. And that core is this: no one is expected to speak honestly about the problem." And I think that suggests that no one will let go of their branches and will hide behind all kinds of platitudes and sayings that just hide the issues, as opposed to, as Wright said, speak honestly about the problem. Well, for a little while, maybe we can share some of our perceptions, and I'm interested in, we're interested together in doing that collectively rather than just hearing from me, and we'll sure have time to do that. But I'd like to share a couple things with you personally that perhaps parallel the journey that all of us take as we become more and more aware of our own racial attitudes, of our own perceptions of what, how American society works. Professionally, and I'm an English teacher, I've had to let go of a lot of branches, a lot of branches that were given to me in my education. Branches, for instance, that say, why was I offered, as an English student, a seminar on William Faulkner? And I'd never heard of Zora Neale Hurston. Why was I offered a whole course on Ernest Hemingway and I didn't know who Richard Wright was? And I have a question on the board that I'm going to ask over and over again. Who decided that for me? Who shaped my perceptions of what American literature, English American literature, really is? I'll share with you another personal example. I had finished my master's degree in American literature. All done. I mean, then American institutions, and I went to two good ones, I think, for my BA and my MA. And they both said to me, "You're ready to teach American youth, American literature, go out in the world." And I had not read one single American black author. I'd never had one covered in a course, and that was okay, according to two institutions. And I'm wondering, my question is, who decided that for me? That it's okay to know about Shakespeare and Keats and Shelley and Byron, but it's not okay, I mean, but and it's also okay not to know about Toni Morrison and Alice Walker and Richard Wright and James Baldwin, and on we go through a list of writers who are perhaps, but in different ways, more important to our perception of what American values and American society and how it works. I'd like to suggest that our attitudes and our perceptions, and I'd rather use the word, it's almost philosophical, our vision of the world is decided for us and what guides me personally through my own journey in literature and my own struggle with racial reconciliation kinds of issues is the New Testament phrase, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." And the truth is very difficult to come to, and to be free of those things that have shaped our values all along, to be free of the institutions and their values that said to me, "No Shakespeare and Keats and Shelley, and don't know Wright and Hurston and etc." You get the point. Who decided that for me? I made a list just before I came in here today. Who decided for me that John Steinbeck is more important than Richard Wright? Who decided for me that Ernest Hemingway should take precedence over James Baldwin? Who decided that John Updike is more important than Toni Morrison? And who decided that Saul Bellow is more important than Alice Walker, or that Carl Sandburg is a better poet than Langston Hughes? I don't know who decided that, but that's all I learned. And I'm suggesting that my perceptions and my values about literature came, there's that question again, who decided that for me? You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. I was fortunate in this little literary struggle with writers that I ran into two teachers who were black literature experts, and they changed my life. But what about all those students who had the same kind of education that I have had, and that also, you know, you're going to teach what you're comfortable with, right? And if I haven't read Richard Wright, I'm sure not going to start teaching him, or Zora Neale Hurston, or someone else. I'm going to stick with those people I know. So we perpetuate this sense of values about what is good literature, and also, even more importantly, we perpetuate this vision of the world and what's normal. Another personal kind of story that I think fits probably all of us. One of my most important role models when I was in high school was my history teacher. And he's a role model for me in many, many ways. But one of the things that I'll never forget that he said, this good, educated, humane person said in class, "You know, students, slavery really wasn't so bad." Well, I was 17 years old, and I said, "Yeah, okay, slavery really wasn't so bad." And where did he get his perception of that? Where did he understand that that's how America worked in the 17th, 18th, and 19th century, that slavery wasn't so bad? And then in my own study later on, I ran across a book by, and I would challenge you not to read it, but to look at it, because it's not worth reading, but it is worth looking at. A guy named Ulrich Phillips wrote a book called American Negro Slavery. Now, Ulrich Phillips is white. And he has, I've skimmed the book, but I've read every single footnote in it. There's about 900 of them. Every single footnote refers to, guess, somebody male and white. And he had what was then, in 1929 when it came out, the definitive book on American Negro Slavery. The title, American Negro Slavery. Written by a white man who never talked or read or looked at something by black people. And at the end of his book, and I remember the paragraph well, "I suspect you could travel far down the road to Shenandoah, as I have to travel much farther before you could come across a slave who was not, dig the word now, content." Your laughter is appropriate. I mean, no way. But he read and used in his notes and in his research the perceptions of white people who in fact were slave owners. And one of those was Charles Norton. Doesn't matter, not a name to remember, but Charles Norton was a plantation owner, and he's footnoted several times in his book about his perception of slavery. One of his perceptions was that that the whites envied the blacks because they didn't have to go to school. His perception was that the blacks enjoyed the freedom of not having shoes because they liked to run around barefoot. Well, since then, folks, I've read the autobiography of Frederick Douglass, and he talks about being barefoot, and it ain't no fun. I use ain't and no to emphasize the negative. And so then along come people like Frederick Douglass and William Wells Brown and Olaudah Equiano and all kinds of slaves who escaped from slavery, and then their perception of slavery turns Ulrich Phillips' whole world upside down. And if the vehicle for American truth, truth in quotes, for my history teacher in high school had not been Ulrich Phillips and his kind, but had been, in fact, as one black writer says, not the perceptions of those who looked on, but the perceptions of those who endured. My history teacher would have said something quite different than, slavery, you know, students, really wasn't so bad. Well, I think about my history teacher, who decided that for him? And how do we arrive at the truth? Here's time for a plug. There are some books in the bookstore that you might enjoy reading. One of them is Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl by Linda Brent. Her real name is Linda Jacobs, but she passed a pseudonym with Linda Brent because for all obvious kinds of publication issues. But there are almost no slave narratives written by women. And it's one important perspective, that is to have the perspective of slavery written by men, the Frederick Douglasses, and you can read the Life and Times of Frederick Douglass written by himself, that's the title of the book, and learn the truth about slavery and the longing for freedom and the risk anything to attain freedom that they went through. And then you read the stories by Linda Brent, who tells us of, and you know about this if you saw Roots back, you know, in the middle 70s, that how the white slave owners used sexually the black slaves. You know, well, okay, that's one thing, it's a kind of rape, but when you read Linda Brent's story, it goes far beyond the physical violence of rape into a spiritual unworthiness that she felt when she prayed, now, since she'd been used by her master, that I'm not worthy to pray to my God. And suddenly the spiritual dimensions of slavery takes on incredible poignancy that surely we can't go along with Ulrich Phillips, who said, I suspect you'd have to travel much farther than I have before you'd come across the discontented slave. The slaves were discontented, and my history teacher was wrong. But what this first little discussion, and we will discuss, is about is really, where do those perceptions come from? How do we arrive at our truths? And some of those come from the historical perspective that has been passed on by, don't want to sound like a revolutionist, but the people in power. And the people in power in America have long been who? White males. And their perception of slavery is what has been passed on to all of us. Well, I brought some other things that I don't want to dwell on. I passed it around ahead of time so you can see it a little more closely. But here is the map of the world. And I'm sorry we're so distant. I don't want to take the time to get closer. Here's the map of the world that most of us, if we're over 30, grew up with. Probably you grew up with it if you're under 30. But just notice that here we have the Soviet Union and China. Split off from part of the Soviet Union, and Africa and Europe are on this side. And that, what's in the center of this map? And just glance at that, and I question that now as an adult. Who decided that for me? That to put the United States in the center, we could split a whole continent when we create the map. Well, I think most geographers now, at least the ones where I teach, are using equal area maps. Not this, it's an interesting title on this. It's the Mercator map, but it's also called, and I'm going to read that, the Rand McNally Popular Map of the World. I like that. Well, here's the equal area map. And from your distance, it's difficult, I know. But those of you who saw it up close, any differences?
Africa's in the center.
Okay, all of a sudden, Africa is in the center, and that's surely different from Africa tucked away in the right-hand corner, isn't it? What else do you notice, as opposed to America being in the center? A little ethnocentrism going on there. Yeah,
Tim. Well, size-wise, that second map shows Africa to be much larger than the United States, which it is.
Yep.
And also Brazil is also larger than the United States.
Yep.
On that map than on the other one.
Good. The whole size of everything in the southern hemisphere on the equal area map. Look at, this is the most obvious one, but you can use it for all kinds of continents. This is Greenland, right here. And this is, compare it with, let's find India. Here's India down here, this little bitty, okay? Greenland, all, well, it's just about as big as all of Africa, okay, on that map. The map that most of us, when we just looked at the world, oh, there's the world, good, and we moved on, didn't think about it, but I wonder what's happening in our subconscious about perspective and about truth, okay? Then on the equal area map, Greenland and Africa. I mean, Greenland would be just a small country, well, a big country, I guess, in Africa. Surely nothing near the size of the whole continent. And the United States, as Tim said, would fit inside just the western half of the northern part. Figure that one out. The western half of the northern part of Africa. Well, I have another question that it keeps cropping up as I look at these things. Who decided that for me? Who shaped my perception of the world that makes me understand that? Well, what does it make you understand? Time for a little exercise right now. I'd like to have you write these. If you don't have a pencil, just think of them then. Let's take 2 minutes and write somewhere between 5 and 10 nouns or adjectives that describe yourself. For instance, I would do this now. I'd write, I'm a father, I'm a son, I'm a husband, I'm a runner. No, I'm not a runner. I'm a jogger. I'd like to be a runner. I'm a teacher, etc. Just some nouns or adjectives that describe yourself. You'll be quizzed on this on Monday. No, today is Monday. Okay, some of you have got some of those down anyway. Let's throw some out. What did you just put down? Anyone, just throw it out.
Wasp.
Wasp? Okay, I'm going to write that one down. Anybody else think of that? Okay. Keep going.
American.
American?
Besides all the relationships, all the
you put down daughter,
yeah,
wife.
Yeah, all the female relationships, but besides that, the first one that came in my head was American.
American. Okay, good. Anybody else?
My first one was woman.
Woman? I'll put that one down.
Christian.
Christian.
Christian. Privilege.
Huh?
Privileged.
Privileged. Good.
Adjectives. I'm privileged.
White.
Said white?
Well, that's a wasp.
That's wasp.
Well, it doesn't have to be. I didn't say it was.
Right. You might not. Yeah, right. How many people in this room put down white? Or thought it? It's a peculiar kind of sensitivity. And I do this little exercise with my classes at Augustana every year. And my classes are there's about 50 or 60 students in the black literature class. And it's usually about 30 black students, about 30 white students. And I'll tell you, it's the same every time. Guess what? Every single black student puts down what?
Black.
And every single white student leaves out white. It's not an issue. It's not part of their everyday thinking that reminds me, hey, I'm white. But the black student, everywhere he or she goes, is reminded, I'm black. And there's something in our culture that makes them mindful of that. And what is it in our culture that makes some people mindful that they're white Anglo-Saxon Protestant? Is it your job? Is it your own particular sensitivities? What is it about our culture that, you know, most men don't put down men, probably. At least not as many men put down men as women put down women. There's something about our culture that makes that an issue, isn't it? Who decided that for me?
My mother.
Yeah. Yeah, well, who's the biologist here? Let's get that cleared up right now. Well, it's another one of those questions on perceptions and on how do I just walk through this world with a sense of who I am, and how is that sense of who I am defined for me? I would suggest that sense of who I am takes on unusual, incredible kinds of power. I did my graduate work at the University of Oregon. It's on the West Coast, nearly, and we had a lot of Asian students there, so once a year there was what they called Polynesian Days, and in all the cafeterias on campus they served Polynesian food. And I remember walking into the cafeteria and, oh boy, here's strawberries and pineapple and this great fruit. And then I got to the main dish, poi. Poi is a root that is pounded and then added, they add water to it and you know, pounded, beat up. And it's, it looks kind of like Holden mud. It tastes kind of like Holden mud. And I took one bite of that stuff and said, no thanks. And I went, ate my fruit and went across the street to McDonald's and got a good old American hamburger. And my Asian friends just said, wow, this is great, you know. And they ate up the poi. Who decided that for me? It isn't, to me, that's an incredible thing, that even my physical taste buds should be affected by my culture. And should, and that I have decided that hamburger, and here's the catch now, because we make qualitative evaluations about these things, I think. Hamburger is better than poi, right? And all of a sudden, the thing, I mean, what happens to chitlins in America? And what happens to hogshead cheese? And what happens to, I'm not even go through the soul food list, and we evaluate, we qualify that kind of stuff, and we make it which is better, which is worse, and who decides our perceptions? I love the New Testament phrase, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. I understand that my physical tastes are affected by the fact that I grew up in America and I like hamburgers better than poi. But now at least I know that it isn't because I have a special morality in choosing hamburgers over poi, it's just something that happened to me culturally. So our perceptions are indeed shaped by that. Let's shift gears quickly and let you understand the perception of Black America as it's told to us through Black literature. And one of the things of this consciousness about who am I and who decides whether I am worthy and whether I am valuable or not, it comes from Richard Wright's great, you know, fictionalized kind of autobiography, Black Boy. It's on sale in the bookstore as well. And it's really one of the great places to start if you're beginning your journey through American blackness. You know, Black Boy is a good place. There are a lot of good places to start, but this is surely one of them. And I put my glasses on because it's pretty dark in here. The situation is that young Richard, he's very young and he's very hungry. His father has left, and now his aunt, who's been providing most of the meals, is gone. And with Aunt Maggie gone, my mother could not earn enough to feed us, and my stomach kept so consistently empty that my head ached most of the day. One afternoon, hunger haunted me so acutely that I decided to try to sell my dog, Betsy, and buy some food. Betsy was a tiny, white, fluffy poodle, and when I had washed, dried, and combed her, she looked like a toy. I tucked her under my arm and went, for the first time, alone, into a white neighborhood, where there were wide, clean streets and big white houses. I went from door to door, ringing the bells. Some white people slammed the door in my face. Others told me to come to the rear of the house, but pride would never let me do that. Finally, a young white woman came to the door and smiled. "What do you want?" she asked. "Do you want to buy a pretty dog?" I asked. "Let me see it." She took the dog into her arms and fondled and kissed it. "What's its name?" "Betsy." "She is cute," she said. "What do you want for her?" "A dollar," I said. "Wait a moment," she said. "Let me see if I have a dollar." And then note the self-consciousness that this little boy brings to this experience. She took Betsy into the house with her, and I waited on the porch, marveling at the cleanliness and quietness of the white world. How orderly everything was. Yet I felt out of place. I had no desire to live here. Then I remembered that these houses were the homes in which lived those white people who made Negroes leave their homes and flee into the night. I grew tense. Would someone say that I was a bad nigger and try to kill me here? What was keeping the woman so long? Would she tell other people that a nigger boy had said something wrong to her? Perhaps she was getting a mob. Maybe I ought to leave now and forget about Betsy. My mounting anxieties drowned out my hunger. I wanted to rush back to the safety of the black faces I knew. Unreasonable fear? Not with the perceptions of self. Who taught him that? That I can't even wait on this porch without wondering and without having fears and anxieties about what she might be doing. And I wrote, the first time I read that, I wrote in my book, and I still have it. That's not my copy. Unreasonable fear, question mark? No. Not with the perception that's been given to him about his own self-worth and his own value and his own ability to work and live in the white world. There's another one, and then I'll stop. And I'm going to ask you to share with us together the kinds of perceptions that we have and maybe where some of those come from. And we're going to try to decide who decided that for me. My church, my religion, my college, you know, maybe we can list some things. But there's one more really quite wonderful illustration in a biography of Langston Hughes. And in fact, for time, I'll skip that one and tell you another story instead. In Not Without Laughter, which is a wonderful novel, another good place to begin, about a young Sandy, it's fiction, growing up. It's kind of the Huck Finn, the catcher in the rye of the black world in a way. Well, Sandy grows up and he's 12 years old, and that's the story. Well, in this one episode I'm referring to, Sandy is black and his little friend Earl, who is white, have been cutting coupons out of the paper for days, for weeks, to save for this amusement park that's coming to town, or this carnival that's coming to town. And it's going to come and they're going to ride the, as he says, the whoop-de-whoops and the Ferris wheels and the merry-go-rounds, and they're going to buy cotton candy, and they're cutting all these coupons for, as I said, for weeks. And finally the day of the carnival comes and school is closed so the kids can go, and Sandy and Earl make this long trek across town to get to the gate, and they get to the gate and Earl holds his tickets up and walks through, and Sandy holds his tickets up, and the ticket taker says, and Langston Hughes, the author, he says carefully about the ticket taker, who was white, that he said, not unkindly, and I want to point that out to you, the ticket taker said, not unkindly, sorry, boy, this party's for white kids only. The ticket taker is an adult. Well, the story continues. Earl comes back to Sandy and says, come on, Sandy, come on. And Sandy gives all his coupons to Earl and says, I'm not going. Why? You got to go. We've been waiting for weeks. You got to go. And he tries to, no, I don't want to go, Earl. I don't want to go. Just you go have a good time. Take my coupons. You'll get some more lemonade. Oh, okay. I'm sorry. And he goes inside. And the episode is over. And I'd like to leave us. I liked Jody's phrase this morning or this afternoon with a comma here. We're not done, but we're done for now. A comma in this whole scene, not as opposed to a period, that is, that says, where does our personal responsibility in understanding the power of racism, where does our personal responsibility begin? There was an adult who collected tickets and said, sorry, this party's for white kids. I would say, what? Should he know better? Should he go against all of the established rules and say, go on in and take a seat and go have fun and I'll just break all the mores of this is not southern United States, even it's in Kansas. I'll break all the traditions and mores of our culture and just go on in there? Is he responsible? How about, and then a tougher question, how about little Earl? He's 12. Sandy is his best friend, and he's never given color a thought. I mean, that's clearly developed in the novel. You have two close friends, and I would suggest to you that Earl, unwittingly, inadvertently, participates in perpetuating the status quo. When does his responsibility begin? Earl at 12... The ticket taker at adult age? Where? Who decided that for me? Who decided that for that ticket taker that this is for whites only and I'm not going to let you in? How did the white ticket taker feel? Maybe he wanted to let him in. Maybe, I don't know. Comma. There we are. The next session that we'll talk about will look very specifically at that wonderful essay by Martin Luther King called A Letter from Birmingham Jail. My wife sacrificed. Where are you? Thank you for doing that. Went up because I forgot them. Went up to our lodge at the top of the hill to get them. If you'd like to have that to bring tomorrow's session and read it ahead of time, that's fine. You don't have to read it to gather, I think, a lot out of the discussion, because King's essay is just so straightforward and clear, and the ideas that we'll highlight will be covered well, I think, in the session. You don't have to read it, but it's there if you'd like to. As a literature teacher, I would suggest that that is probably one of the great American essays of all time. That's not debatable, because you could make that 1,000 or 10 million, whatever you want. Before we close, and let's have a chance, who decided what for me? What are some of the attitudes that maybe you have, that friends that you know have? How do we begin this journey of racial reconciliation, what W.E.B. Du Bois called the greatest problem of the 20th century, is the problem of the color line. And how do we begin that journey of reconciling our perceptions and our attitude and our vision of the world? I'm going to quote Jody again, because I love the phrase and I'll never forget it. Well, this afternoon, we in America look at racial distinctions as a problem. And perhaps you ought to look at it as a blessing, that we have racial distinctions and the beauty of that. Well, our vision of the world needs to be tipped upside down. That's a very Christian concept, of course. Okay, your turn. What perceptions did you grow up with, maybe? Black people are always late.
Uh-oh. I can explain.
You don't have to, but okay, anybody. I mean, I grew up, for instance, thinking slavery wasn't so bad, because I was told that. Who decided that for me? What else has been decided for us?
What, one of the things that comes to mind is growing up and watching The Little Rascal on TV and having Steinem and Buckwheat as the two black characters, two black children, and they were always, they were never in the leadership role per yep. se. They were never yep. the thinkers. They were always the kind of, they were slow, basically what it was.
Yep. Think back to the movies that you've seen and the television productions and so on of the role that black people have been assigned to. How about that famous Gone with the Wind? You know,
Step and Fetch It.
Step and Fetch It. Kinds of images. That's right.
Amos
and Andy. So. TV and movies, who decided that for me, that should be my perception of blackness? Well, TV and movies decide a lot of that.
Well, this is just a different perception, but I think there's a real gut level thing white women sometimes fight with, as far as if you see a young black man in a situation where you're alone, there is in the face of all sorts of intellectual things, there can be a fear reaction.
That's right. There's a real different perspective of sexuality, white toward black and black toward white. And if you study slavery, it's an ironic twist, because the people who were exploited and raped out there were blacks by whites. But yet somehow that's been tipped over upside down a lot by, I think I'll add, by literature too. That suggests, the Southern Belle must not be touched. And we wonder, look at it historically, why Nat Turner went after women and children in the Great Rebellion of 1832. Why did he? This Christian thinking man, it's a real complex issue, but the people that he went after were women and children. somehow, as I understand that in the big historical picture, is that he's trying to, not that he's conscious of this, I don't know, undo the myths that have been so much a part of American slavery. Good. Others?
Marketing.
What?
Marketing.
Marketing. How so? Give an example.
Marketing and tokenism. Actually, I think
Marketing
and tokenism is what I sort of think of. The commercial that has a black in it and a white and someone of Asian persuasion, whatever. It seems the commercial is frequently targeted at the white at the center of the commercial and on the periphery, the token presence of the black or the Asian.
And how does that, what does that do to your perception?
Well, I guess like your map. Why is the United States
the
center? It's sort of ridiculous.
Good analogy. Like the map, the United States is all still without the black. Let's keep them off the side.
But they will also market to where the races are. In other words, you go into certain parts of the United States, and they will put predominant black, actors on there because they're marketing to the black.
You can always tell that it's a white advertising firm that's put together the commercial.
Yeah. You've heard of the book Uncle Tom's Cabin? Mm-hmm. The famous Abraham Lincoln looked at the author and said, "So you're the little lady who started the Civil War." And that was an important book. But Uncle Tom was portrayed as what? This contented, subservient kind of slave. Well, Richard Wright has a wonderful, not deliberately a sequel, but it ought to be, called Uncle Tom's Children. And Uncle Tom's children are not subservient, and they struggle and fight for their rights and for their own humanity.
I think on who decided that, for me, separation is just pivotal. The fact that we are, in most cases, separated so entirely that we don't have a chance to make relationships, at least in many cases.
And who decided that we should be separate? One of the issues here is we can all dismiss our personal responsibility, can't we? And that racism is so institutionalized, and by that I mean in the broadest sense institutionalized, it's part of institutions as well as part of just historical attitudes, that we can dismiss our individual responsibility. So who's responsible for these lines of demarcation that have separated black from white? Historically, in America.
Is the geography where you live?
Yeah. So it ain't me, is it? It's geography. That was Nixon's favorite trick. The White House has decided. Kind of dismiss the, how I thought. Who's in the White House? Take it. Tell me that you decided. Okay, geography.
I think going along with geography, I cannot say geography is there, but I think there's another thing because there wasn't there just last week or so a study saying that the racial group that has the most difficult time assimilating housing-wise in the whole country is the black race. The Latinos can assimilate, the Asians assimilate into white neighborhoods much more easily than the blacks do. So it is geography in one respect, but there's also something else there.
Yeah.
And I don't know what that is. I come from San Francisco, which is a very racially mixed city. And I've lived in Detroit, which is a very
divided
city, and it's night and day. But still, even San Francisco is racially. There are areas where blacks live, although it's much more interracially mixed. But there is something other than just geography.
Right.
People from the Midwest, I think, would be very surprised living in San Francisco for a year.
Probably the area that has been the longest lasting in terms of influence and still exists today and will tomorrow is politics. And this is where we all have a responsibility.
Yep. Good.
From the beginning of slavery to very thing we're just talking about. Housing.
And that's an interesting comment in light of the last election and the whole role that Jesse Jackson played in that, and the continuing role that he and other black leaders will be playing. That's a good point.
Well, the Mormon Church has even blamed the Bible. Their legislation against blacks. Equality.
Yep. As an English teacher, I've read research papers. They don't get very good grades, let me tell you. arguing for racial separation, and they based it on things out of the Bible. Well, they're bad readers, of course.
As the,
that's my job. Is
the Dutch
bad readers.
The Dutch church in South Africa still
of
has
course.
Yeah.
Yes.
Of course. South Africa really parallels American Jim Crowism for years.
Education and Vietnam.
Yep. And the example that I gave you of my own education as a literature teacher. It's okay. You don't have to be Richard Wright. Who cares? Just make sure you know Faulkner, Shakespeare, and get out there and teach the kids.
And that extends to the whole concentration on Western culture.
Yep. And then those people go out and teach the world what they've been taught. As my history teacher, Ivan.
May I present two of my understanding, two points of view. I partially agree with those they decide for us, but also I think they are all outside of us, and I think those decide maybe up to a certain age, and then if that's the only way you know what TV presents, up to a certain age you can say those decide, and because they are outside of us, then I would say individuals decide, but it costs to say you decide. Take the Bible, for example. People can do what is outside what the Bible says, or they can do just the opposite of what TV says. In that case, I would say the individual person decides when they know the truth. The truth has been talking about. But that costs. So
yeah.
two things, your age, if that's all you know, that takes South Africa, if that's all I know to be right, then I agree. But when I reach a certain age, even if I've never been outside South Africa, I will know the truth. For example, right now, many school kids, white school children, are choosing murder rather than being trained to be soldiers. At that age, who decides? I would say they decide. They've never been outside, but so in that case, we can't say geography decides because those children have never been outside South Africa. So.
That's a great point, and part of what the black writers are about is to, I think, is to suggest all those defining forces and their powers so that as we become aware of those, we can. We're aware of how we can choose, and that's our issue with Earl and the ticket taker. At what point does personal responsibility come in, and what cost are we willing to pay? It's very good. I don't know what time we're supposed to stop now because of what time we started, so, but I don't want to cut anyone off. Yeah.
I'm two areas, both have come out of newspapers. One's always the sporting section. Which always makes, tries to, sports writers will always write about how many blacks are on a team, especially when it comes to National Basketball Association. They'll write about the, you know, this team has so many blacks on it, and they have a black coach, but they never write about which teams have predominant white. They always have to make a point about teams being black. And then also on news, I've noticed too in the years, whenever there's a report of a rape or a violent murder, they always go out of the way to mention that it was a black or a Hispanic or something, but they never said this person was white that committed. They always assume that if they put the name that you think that my person might be white.
Good.
A couple of things that come to mind is, one is, we have a society that has a very low self-appreciation. And so emotionally, we are constantly in competition with each other. And then when you add the economics of that to it, we can just take a look at two kids, youngsters going to school, male, female, boy, whatever. They could be a white kid and a black kid, and they'll go to elementary school and go to college together, and they're buddies. But once they cross the barrier of getting out of college and going to compete for the same jobs, the economy, the economics have to come into picture. And a whole different ballgame of survival develops. And it really all seems, a lot of it seems to emanate that we have not actualized Christ-likeness in ourselves. So we're not applying his principles. We're applying man's principles. And man's principles say you stay on top. And in order for you to be on top, somebody has to be on the bottom. Just a basic survival of the fittest method that we operate. And we do the same thing in our churches. We have elevated everything to a level of culture and aesthetics. And that excludes a whole lot of folks who haven't had those opportunities. But that's our protection. And geographics, that's our protection. Because we decide what neighborhoods we live in. We decide what size house, or whether I have a swimming pool and a jacuzzi and da-da-da-da-da-da that keeps the bills running up. But it's some other factors of the old concept of redlining that's still in operation extensively. But we decide. But we refuse to take responsibility for deciding.
That's very good, and that's one of the, it's very insightful, and that's what's going on in our Supreme Court and has been for, maybe forever since Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896, but for a long time, individuals have been willing to hear Supreme Court, make this decision for me. I don't want to have to wrestle with it myself. Good cost is too great. But if I can say this is what the law says, that's
right. I think it's interesting. Lou used a different language what we've been talking about. Lou used principles of the faith over against the more economic language of values and cost, which is subtly shifted over the years into that whole economic realm where it almost captivates the whole arena right now. And so the principles of Christ-like living is a foreign language.
Yeah. Anybody else?
I have a question about the lease there. Question is a little bit different from who decided. Maybe since we know some of the things they decide for us, is there anything we can do about it? TVs, newspapers, all of those. What can we do about those? Do we have control over that list, or we can't control it?
Well, let's look at some success stories. What have some of you done that has broadened your vision of the world or has changed your perspective? For instance, we can read Ulrich Phillips, go back to the beginning, right, and have that perception of slavery, or we can read Frederick Douglass and have a different one. That's one way to go about changing our vision of the world.
Well, I think the black authors have done more for me than anything I can think of, because they just take you right back to their roots and you know how they feel about things, why they did what they did, and you can see as a white how you have misinterpreted things that have gone on, where they to save face, they've just pretended all was well when it was not.
Travel and live in other places.
Yeah. That was one of our challenges this morning, is to get out of where you have lived and where you have been secure all your life and see see and experience another culture.
By the way, in a Bill Moyers interview with Maya Angelou, I'm sure you saw it, they went back to her hometown of Stamps, Arkansas, and she was all very lighthearted and gay about the situation, but she admitted that there, right there, the railroad tracks was where, as a black, as a child, she was afraid to go, and she still did not want to go. She made light of it for the interview, and he didn't press her, but she said, no, I don't want to go there. I am still not comfortable.
That's another good place to begin, folks. Maya Angelou.
Yeah.
Good. I saw him, but okay.
Yeah.
It's maybe worth wondering why the South has done relatively well in changing over the last 30 years or so, whereas the same sorts of things aren't happening in Boston and a lot of other cities. It may have something to do with the fact that it's been much easier for the South to admit that they had racial problems, that they were openly racist. And it's very hard to do that in the North. I had an experience about 2 weeks ago on a lunch counter in Baltimore where the counterman was talking to an old friend of his named Bert, and he said, Bert, what do you think about Frank Robinson, the baseball team's manager in Baltimore? He said, he's doing a great job. Smartest black man I've ever heard of. And the counterman said, Bert, I'm surprised to hear you say that. And Bert said, but don't get me wrong, I'm still a racist. But he's the smartest black man I've ever heard of. And the fact that he was able to say, I'm racist, is at least an opening for him being able to change. It's much harder to do that, I think, if it is considered inappropriate to consider race.
If you had her do over again, would you stay and eat the poet?
Well, I stayed. I just didn't eat the poet. I don't know. I had friends that I stayed with. And that's a good question to deal with on how we deal with our own tastes, you know. Some things are...
I meant that in the most general sense.
Yeah. Think of it. Okay, yeah, I'd stay and eat it. Okay. Thank you.
You can see you.
That's right.